The Last Man, 1826. While Mary Shelley was working on posthumous poems, she received yet more disastrous news. Byron had died of malaria in Greece, where he had been fighting in the War of Independence from the Ottoman Empire. The English clergy refused to bury him in Westminster, and so he was laid to rest in the family vault near Newstead. Mary Shelley watched the funeral procession from the window of the cottage she was renting. To her, it seemed the end of an era. In her journal, she wrote that she was a survivor, the last man. Yes, I may well describe that solitary being's feelings, feeling myself as the last relic of a beloved race, my companions extinct before me. Inspired as it was by grief and heartbreak, Mary Shelley's next book dramatized the words of her journal, The Last Man. After the losses she had sustained and the dramatic changes in her life, Mary Shelley's aims were broader than in Valperga. She was still preoccupied with the principles of reform, but she wanted to go further and write about the shattering of the world, her sense that humankind was on the brink of extinction. In the preface, she writes that she has deciphered the tale from words traced on leaves that she and a friend discovered in Naples, in the cave of the Cumaean Sibyl, a cave that she and Percy did in fact visit. By declaring that she is the one who has written down this story, she links herself to her very first book, 6 Weeks, which she edited and wrote largely on her own, and the female editors of her previous novels, Margaret Saville Walton, Matilda, and Euthanasia, who are all the organizers and preservers of the stories they tell. This authorial intrusion is the only moment Mary Shelley enters the story, but it is an important moment. On the one hand, the discovery of the leaves is as much a fiction as the tale she sets out to tell, but it is also useful preparation for the imaginative flight to come, as the novel is set far in the future, beginning in 2073 and ending in 2100, tracing the course of a global pandemic that ultimately kills everyone except the narrator, Lionel Verney. Mary Shelley had explored the idea of authorial intrusion a few years before in Giovanni Villani, one of the essays she had written for The Liberal right after Percy died. In this work, she explains that sometimes, when the author speaks directly to the reader, a chord could be awakened, which otherwise might have gone unheard. In another essay from the same time period, On Ghosts, she argues that setting and atmosphere are essential elements when creating the supernatural in fiction. To demonstrate her point, she includes her own experience of mourning a lost friend, Percy, and visiting the last house where she had seen him. Interestingly, she spends more time describing the house itself than her encounter with his spirit. Only at the end of the passage does she say, "Methought I heard, I felt, I know not what, but I trembled." In The Last Man, though, when Mary Shelley announces her identity as the editor, she does this not only to establish the novel's futuristic setting, but to assert her authority over the narrative, claiming that the leaves were so difficult to read that there would have been no story without her efforts. It is she, therefore, who is the invisible hand behind Lionel's narrative, and though she does not re-enter the story, her mark on the novel is clear. She has framed it as her story, as much if not more than the narrator's, her first and only such assertion as a novelist. When The Last Man begins, it appears to follow the same trajectory as Frankenstein and Valperga. Like Castruccio and the creature in Frankenstein, Lionel is angry and dreams of revenge for wrongs that were done to his family. But unlike the earlier characters, he undergoes a conversion. He has sworn to hate Adrian, the crown prince whom he believes has harmed his family. But when they meet, Lionel is inspired by Adrian's idealism. Modeled on Percy, Adrian embodies many of the poet's virtues and political dreams. He renounces the throne in an attempt to turn England into the Republic of Mary Shelley's dreams. Lionel, inspired by Adrian's commitment to justice, learns to follow Adrian's lead and devote himself to others. But over time, he also learns that Adrian is sometimes too idealistic. Occasionally, he loses sight of reality when his dreams and visions overpower him. Another important male character, Lord Raymond, offers a counterpoint to Adrian. Modeled after Byron, Raymond is an ambitious nobleman who achieves fame by helping the Greeks win independence from the Turks. In contrast to Adrian, Raymond dreams of power, but he restrains himself for a time because he is in love with Lionel's sister and marries her. The friends enjoy a peaceful sojourn in the countryside, but instead of following philosophical principles like Adrian, Raymond is impulsive and emotional, and this will be his undoing. As the monarchy has been abolished, he becomes instead the Lord Protector of England, and then returns to the war in Greece, where he dies in an explosion, the result of a trap laid by the Turks. There are many other subplots that run throughout the novel, but the second half of the book focuses on the progress of the pandemic, which spreads rapidly across Europe and America. Survivors from America plunder Ireland, Scotland, and England. The weather becomes apocalyptic. A black sun causes panic. Seacoast towns are flooded by storm surges. In France, a false messiah rises up, leading followers in a strange, fanatical cult. Lionel and Adrian and their friends escape for a time to Switzerland, but when the disease finds them there, they sail to Greece. However, a sudden storm sinks their ship, drowning Adrian. Lionel escapes by swimming to shore, landing on the beach in Ravenna, where he finds no one else alive. He follows the road to Rome, his only companion a sheepdog he finds along the way. The city is empty when he arrives, and he contents himself with spending a year alone in Rome, musing over the fate of civilization, saddened but still fully sane, having endured more pain than he could have imagined when he was young. Over the course of the novel, he has learned to reject the extremes of both Adrian and Raymond. He is idealistic, like Adrian, but is still able to grasp reality. He is moved by emotions like Raymond, but still has control over his actions. Accordingly, he does not rage at his fate, nor is he deluded by his dreams or wishes. Instead, he weeps as he faces the reality of his situation, able to experience grief instead of anger. Unlike the male characters in Mary Shelley's previous novels, or even his younger self, at first, he feels self-conscious for being girlish. But ultimately, he embraces his capacity to have deep and authentic feelings, having become more like Euthanasia than Castruccio. Suffering has transformed him and redeemed him. The conventional boundaries between male and female have blurred, and he sets sail to find another survivor across the sea. For all its horrific and prescient vision of the future, The Last Man suggests the possibility of growth and change, a possibility that is lacking in Mary Shelley's earlier works, where the male characters cannot be swayed from their paths. Lionel survives, she suggests, because he is the one character who has allowed himself to evolve. Early on, he drops his revenge fantasies, an impossibility for Castruccio, Frankenstein, and his creature, and learns to experience sorrow instead of rage, containing the horror of the apocalypse by writing down his story, just as Mary Shelley's other survivors had. Unlike her earlier characters, who are all women, Lionel is able to have a future. Matilda commits suicide, Euthanasia drowns, and MWS's fate is unknown. But Lionel sets forth on a quest. Of course, in such a bleak novel, it is difficult to see this as a bright moment, and yet Lionel's wisdom at the end of the novel is hopeful. He has attained a reasoned viewpoint and an ethical stance on the disaster that has struck the world. A solitary being is by instinct a wanderer, he reflects, as he prepares to leave Rome. I shall witness all the variety of appearance that the elements can assume. I shall read fair augury in the rainbow, menace in the cloud, some lesson or record dear to my heart in everything. In the end, after what he has experienced, he declares that he will be able to read all the signs of the world. When The Last Man was published in January 1826, the response was overwhelmingly negative. Critics complained that Mary Shelley's writing was too dark. In an era that celebrated progress, The Last Man's pessimism struck a discordant note. Humankind was on the brink of calamity, Mary Shelley implied, leading pundits to wonder what kind of woman had dreamed up this nightmare vision. Sir Timothy was so horrified that he withheld Mary Shelley's allowance, but she fought back, hiring her lawyer to force him to resume payments. Although there were a few positive responses, the artist John Martin painted a series of works inspired by the novel, An Ideal Design of the Last Man, and the book was translated into French. She was disheartened by its poor sales and promised her publisher that her next book would be more popular. Though downcast by the novel's sales, Mary Shelley did not abandon her reformist ideals. Instead, she applied her philosophy to her life, tackling hypocrisy and suffering by spending her money and her time helping her women friends. The virtues of her ideal female character, euthanasia, were the virtues she wanted to uphold in her own life: integrity, balance, empathy, reason, courage, and common sense. Accordingly, she helped a dear friend elope with another woman to Europe. 19-year-old Isabel Robinson had a baby out of wedlock and confided in Mary Shelley that if her father discovered this, he would cast her out of the house. Mary Shelley's friend, Mary Diana Dodds, Dottie, who was notorious for her affairs with women, was in love with Isabel, and so Mary Shelley and Dottie conceived of a plan where Dottie would pose as a man and set off for France with Isabel. Once there, they would pretend to be man and wife. After a few years, Dottie would fade away, and Isabel could go back home to England, a respectable widow with a child. It was an absurd plan, and if they were caught, they would all face disgrace. But Mary Shelley was her mother's daughter, and so she assumed the role of mastermind. At the end of the summer, Isabel and Dottie moved to France, and a few years later, Isabel returned to England with her daughter. No one was ever the wiser. Mary Shelley also gave financial assistance to many other women friends, including Jane, the widow of Percy's friend, Edward Williams, and Claire. She gave advice and counsel to the young women in her social circle and beyond, befriending those who were cast out for immorality or other social infractions. The Fortunes of Perkin Warbeck, 1830. The Last Man did not earn enough money to support Mary Shelley and Percy Florence. Godwin, too, continued to need her financial support, and so Mary Shelley persevered by writing stories for magazines. The audience for these was primarily women, and many of the stories echo the themes of her novels: power, male ambition, female righteousness, love, the supernatural, ghosts, and the imagination. The most notable of these, A Tale of the Passions, The Brother and Sister, The Heir of Mondolfo, The Dream, The Mortal Immortal, and Transformation, demonstrate her continued commitment to expanding the range of the Gothic to include ideas of radical, political, and social reform, as well as a celebration of the imagination and the dignity of women. In Transformation, for example, she appears at first to be writing a Gothic tale about Guido, a selfish young man who trades places with a dwarf for the sake of hedonistic pleasure, but becomes trapped in the dwarf's body. In a more conventional tale, like Charles Robert Maturin's Melmoth the Wanderer, the central character would be damned forever. But Mary Shelley adds a characteristic edge to the story. By allowing Guido to find the dwarf, return to his own form, and marry his true love, Juliet, Juliet, however, does not accept him back as though nothing had happened. Guido tells the reader that Juliet sometimes ventures to allude bitterly to the malice that caused this change, suggesting that, although he has returned, his mistake has not vanished from the record. Juliet has not forgotten, and she will not let him forget either. In 1829, Mary Shelley also lent secret support to a new publication of Percy's work, giving editorial assistance and providing some biographical details. She was glad to see his poetry gaining a readership, but she still yearned to write his biography and to bring out a complete edition of his work. However, since Sir Timothy's restrictions still held her back, she turned to fiction, setting her new novel, The Fortunes of Perkin Warbeck, in the 15th century, once again embedding her radical messages in history. As in Valperga, she felt no need to stay true to historical events, shaping the characters and backdrop to suit her own ends. In the preface, she says that facts are not enough to do justice to the story. As the critic Aaron L. W. Garrett argues, she uses fiction to critique the historical record. The real Perkin Warbeck was a pretender to the English throne, who claimed to be the escaped Richard, Duke of York, the second son of King Edward IV, one of the little princes who had been imprisoned in the Tower. In Mary Shelley's novel, Perkin is who he says he is, Richard, the inheritor of the throne. But though she depicts Richard as idealistic and empathic, a good and virtuous man, he is not the hero of her tale. Neither is Henry VII, his opponent, whom she depicts as power-hungry and villainous. Rather, it is Catherine Gordon, Richard's wife, a real historical figure, whom Mary Shelley reimagines as the true beacon of light in the novel. The war over the throne is causing suffering to the people, Catherine declares, fighting against Richard's ambition, just as euthanasia had resisted Castruccio. Also, like euthanasia, she argues on behalf of peace. It is not war that will improve the condition of humankind, she says. What really matter are harmony and love, the embracing of rational and domestic values, and the creation of a sentimental community for those who have fellow feeling with the oppressed, as Mary Shelley had first envisioned in 6 Weeks, and which she would continue to develop in her final novels. As Betty T. Bennett has explained, when Perkin Warbeck was published in 1830, contemporary critics ignored the radical anti-war message, just as they had with Valperga, overlooking the Republican politics embedded in the plot. The New Monthly magazine praised the novel's feminine delicacy of feeling and its peculiar charm. Although these were comparatively positive reviews for a novel by Mary Shelley, she was still disappointed at how, once again, reviewers had missed the central points. Some 20th century critics disliked the novel for the opposite reason, viewing it as not political enough. To them, Catherine Gordon's anti-war and anti-monarchical views were problematic, as they signaled a retreat from the public to the private realm and a prioritization of the domestic sphere over the political. But both readings of the novel misrepresent Mary Shelley's aims as an author, particularly as a female writer committed to advancing the cause of women. One of the most important innovations of Perkin Warbeck is that Mary Shelley gives Catherine Gordon her own voice. She calls attention to this by including a footnote where she writes, "The character of the Lady Catherine Gordon is a favorite of mine. I desired, therefore, that she speak for herself." Mary Shelley's editorial remarks underline the centrality of both the female author and her female protagonist. When Catherine speaks, she argues for liberty in the face of tyranny. To her, it is the fight for power that causes suffering for the people, and she argues for peace. But of course, these are Mary Shelley's words, as she had to invent Catherine's speeches. The chronicles of this time period rarely include accounts of women, even of queens. As Aaron Webster concludes, Mary Shelley's blend of fiction and fact makes the novel a revisionary history. Without the devices of fiction, she would not have been able to give Catherine Gordon a voice. Mary Shelley's politics are further illustrated by the letter she wrote during the same year that she published Perkin Warbeck. Still an avid follower of international politics, she was heartened to read that General Lafayette was promoting reform in France, and wrote him a letter praising his proposals. To friends, she wrote that the wealthy in England needed to sacrifice their own riches rather than taxing the poor. Most interesting of all, she wrote to the publisher John Murray, proposing two book ideas. First, a history of woman, and second, a lives of celebrated women. Murray declined these proposals, but they demonstrate Mary Shelley's ambition to make the lives of women her central focus. Surprisingly, there was a positive side to the critical misunderstanding of Mary Shelley's work. Although she was still regarded as a scandalous figure by the old guard, she had attained a literary stature that had seemed unattainable when she was the 20-year-old anonymous author of Frankenstein. In 1830, the Athenaeum declared that she was the most distinguished literary woman of her time, and the publisher, Bentley, offered Mary Shelley a place on its list for Frankenstein, if she revised it so that they could own the copyright. The New Frankenstein, 1831. Mary Shelley embraced the opportunity to rethink her first novel. The tragedies she had endured had taken their toll, and in this new version of her book, she painted an even bleaker picture of the world than in the original. In the first edition, Victor has at least some freedom to choose whether to pursue his ambitions. When he makes the wrong choice, it is his own action that brings about his downfall. But in this new version, Mary Shelley strips him of any agency. He is a puppet in the hands of inexorable forces, a man who must obey his impulses. Elizabeth, too, has far less independence. She is now an orphan instead of Victor's cousin, a change in status that reinforces her weakness, as she has no family of her own. Victor's mother gives her to Victor as a pretty present, and for the remainder of the story, she is his to dispose of at will. By diminishing Elizabeth, Mary Shelley demonstrated the danger of depriving women of their independence. Without a Catherine Gordon or a euthanasia to fight against the destructive force of male ambitions, everyone in the novel suffers. On another note, as the scholar Susan Wolfson argues, by making Elizabeth an orphan, Mary Shelley can show how her adoption by the Frankenstein family is racially inflected. Many scholars have pointed to Mary Shelley's stance against slavery in the first edition, arguing that the creature's hardships are based, in part, on the slave narratives Mary Shelley had read. But in this new edition, Mary Shelley goes further, painting an even more disturbing picture of the consequences of racism by emphasizing the harm done by the prejudices of the central characters. Victor's mother discovers the blonde Elizabeth when she passes by a dark-eyed peasant family who have adopted the orphan child. Immediately, Mrs. Frankenstein wants to take Elizabeth away and raise her as her own. Mary Shelley emphasizes the child's whiteness, writing that Elizabeth's hair is golden and that she is fairer than a garden rose among dark-leaved brambles, making it clear that it is her fair, white skin and golden hair that attract Mrs. Frankenstein. In contrast, the other orphan in the story is neglected and abandoned. No one wants to adopt Frankenstein's abandoned creature because of his ugliness, an ugliness that many critics view as racially coded. For instance, Mary Shelley describes the creature's lips and hair as black and his skin as yellow. John Malcho suggests that Mary Shelley's depiction is based on her society's general image of the Negro body, in which repulsive features, brute-like strength, and size of limbs featured prominently. Karen Linear Piper argues that the creature represents the Inuits, the missing presence of indigenous people during Walton's Arctic expedition. Because people recoil from him, the creature learns to hate his own appearance, seeing himself as a miserable deformity who will never be accepted by human beings. By contrasting the stories of Elizabeth and the creature, Mary Shelley emphasizes the injustice that the creature faces simply because he looks different from the other characters. No matter how hard he tries, no matter how much he seeks love and educates himself, society will always see him as savage and monstrous. And so this new edition of Frankenstein becomes a story about what Wolfson calls the disturbing and violent consequences of racialized preference and value. As the scholar Adam Poetke demonstrates, the novel has played an important role in African-American literary naturalism, influencing famous works such as Roger Wright's Native Son. By the time she finished with her revision, Mary Shelley had written her most pessimistic book, even more so than The Last Man, as at least Lionel undergoes a redemptive transformation. By weakening Elizabeth, she has sharpened the effects of male aggression. By racializing Elizabeth and the creature, she drew attention to the fraught debate over Britain's Slavery Abolition Act, which would finally be passed in 1833 for all British colonies. She did retain M.W.S. as the editor, but her voice is even more buried under the layers of the narrative. As in The Last Man, this new edition of Frankenstein went against the grain of the optimism of the period, particularly the belief that science would ensure progress and that civilization would improve the lives of people everywhere. But Mary Shelley had no patience with these clichés. Everywhere she looked, she saw injustice, poverty, and hypocrisy. Driven by her need to expose class hatred, racism, and prejudice, she told her story with as much power as she could. The reissuing of Frankenstein confirmed Mary Shelley's fame, and yet she was still poor. In the 10 years since Percy had died, Sir Timothy had never raised her allowance. The magazines paid well enough, and she earned some money from her fiction, but between her expenses and those of her son, Godwin, and the rest of her friends and family who leaned on her for financial support, she seemed to be always in debt, always struggling to make ends meet.